My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm happy to be speaking with Chris Cleave. Chris, welcome to Portland, and welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Ed.
The title of your book is Little Bee. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Lenny Bruce once said that thousands of people die every day from poverty and disease, and nobody really thinks much about it. But one little girl falls down a well, and the whole country doesn't sleep for a week.
Sure.
Is that what this book is about, in a way?
Yeah, absolutely. It's that old thing that, one death is a tragedy, but a million deaths are a statistic. And I like to use fiction, and this is something that I think you can do in a novel, to give back a measure of humanity to the subjects of a big ongoing news story. So yeah, I take a big thing, geopolitics, immigration, refugees, and I try to make it small enough to see. I try to put it into the lives of one or two people and really make those characters come alive and make them funny and make them likable. There's nothing worse than a novel that's preachy or a novel that feels like a sermon or a lecture. And yet I do, I'm really drawn to these big stories, to these politicized stories. And I guess, I'm kind of an activist as a novelist. I want to write about stuff, and I want things to change. And, I think that's what good journalists do as well. And I think that's what I can do in fiction, just give back a measure of humanity to people by just talking about people rather than politics, which, of course, is a political thing to do.
It's the same. Poli and people. Politics is all about people, like
sure.
Population and
Well,
what was a polis? It was a city in Greece. So the city was the people, and the city was the people that run the people.
The populace.
Just setting this up, Little Bee is a character. She's African. She's Nigerian, specifically.
That's right.
And we first meet her really in a detention center, a refugee center, where she's sitting there for 2 years waiting to be granted entry or be deported. But in the meanwhile, she's simply vegetating in this place. And this is her story. One thing I noticed about the book is that it starts out with a lot of snarky humor in it. There's a lot of funny kind of, I don't want to say cynical so much as it's askance humor. It has a kind of a jaundiced point of view. But by the end of the book, the humor has disappeared. Did you do that naturally, or did that just emerge as the story emerged?
I don't really write deliberately, and this is one of my huge problems as a writer, is that I don't plot them out in advance. I wish I could. It would save a lot of heartache. The characters start to seem really alive to me, and I write them as far as I can. I try to push myself, emotionally as far as I can with the characters. And as the characters became more embroiled in something which starts to look more and more like a tragedy, I found that there was less and less to laugh about. Mm-hmm. And by the end, the strange effect has been achieved. So at the beginning, you're introduced to these two funny characters with a little edge of tragedy that you suspect will be about to be revealed. And by the end, you get these two characters who are really embroiled in something that's bigger than themselves and from which they can't escape. And they're kind of clinging to their sense of humor by the end, rather than being propelled by it. And that was, I think, a natural effect that emerged as I told this story, which became more and more desperate. And in some ways, when you look at the plight of refugees, I use the humor to make it accessible, because I want people to be interested in these people's stories, because I think those people are really interesting. And yet by the end, if you're going to tackle the subject seriously, there's very little to laugh about, sadly, because these people will often be deported back to places where they're likely to be tortured and killed. And that's for me, represents a kind of limit of humor. There's a line that you can't really step over without belittling the importance of a subject. So yeah, the laugh coefficient definitely diminishes as you go through the book. And yet I hope that something else happens as well, which is that in the place of the humor, this kind of resilient, lovable stoicism emerges in the characters, and you realize that by the end of it, they've found a different way to cope with the tragedy that's presented to them. So at the beginning, they can laugh it off, and by the end, they almost have to love it off. You know, they have to look after each other, otherwise they will be destroyed.
If I forget to do this later on, please remind me. I want you to tell us about all of the thoughts that Little B has that start with the line, "If the men come for me."
Sure.
Because that starts out funny, and then after a while you realize why it's not so funny. But
yeah.
You may know that we have our own immigration problem in this country. And as usual, Americans are desperately ignorant about anything that's going on outside of our borders. So we know about the Mexicans coming in and the Hondurans all coming up across the Mexican border to look for work. We know about people coming in across the Canadian border with Commonwealth passports who may or may not have our best interests in mind here in the United States. What's going on in England with that? Is the situation similar? Is England living in a state of kind of low-level paranoia?
Yeah, state of I'd classify it as medium to high medium level to paranoia. High.
Yeah, it's the most observed culture on earth. There are more CCTVs around London looking at people than anywhere else in the world.
It's
right?
An extraordinary place to live at the moment because that we have. Yeah, there's a lot of surveillance. Which doesn't bother me so much. And what bothers me is a lack of constitutional protection for us as citizens. I mean, you guys are really lucky, you know, you deserve the Constitution because you fought for it.
Assuming the president reads the Constitution and understands it.
Well, you're lucky to have a president now who does, you know, who's familiar with the document. And that's something that we don't have in the UK, for better or worse. So it's not really so much that we're the most heavily surveilled society, as the fact that we don't have any protections for our privacy. We don't have anything that says, well, this evidence can be used to defend us as well as to prosecute us. And so it's an odd, you know, as you say, there's a strange climate. It is in many ways a fearful climate because we have this, I think xenophobia is too strong a word for it, but there's a suspicion of outsiders coming in, which is relatively new in Britain because, you know, we've always been, you know, a gateway country. We've always been based on successive waves of immigration. You know, we're
and
since 1066, you know, we're French. You know, we need to get over ourselves. I mean, we're a mishmash of a people. And, you know, a lot of people love that about Britain. And I was brought up to love that. And yet something has changed. You know, there's a tabloid media culture now which tries to conflate, and I think deliberately conflates, a bunch of things which should actually be considered as unrelated. So there's a big issue about terrorism, right? Terrorists are foreigners, right? And largely they might have a different skin colour from people who live in the UK. There's a generalized suspicion of people coming into the country, which the tabloid press fuel by always mentioning a foreign criminal or terrorist in the same breath as asylum seeker. Right? Now, these are two very different things.
Mm-hmm.
An asylum seeker is someone who hasn't chosen to flee from their country. They haven't done anything wrong. They haven't broken the law. It's actually legal to come to the Western countries and ask for asylum, you know, ask for protection. And, you know, to deliberately fuel the suspicion that those people might be trying to harm our society is something that I think the tabloid press are doing and doing very effectively. Also, there's some people need to look at the numbers more carefully and to get a sense of proportion. If in the, I mean, I'm not speaking for America here. I wouldn't presume to, but in my country, you know, people might find a parallel with what's happening in my country. Asylum seekers represent, you know, on a month-on-month basis, between 2-3% of net immigration to the United Kingdom, and yet there's this perception that there's this flood of asylum seekers that's going to overwhelm us. Well, that isn't actually true. There's very few of them, and they really do need our help. And if I look back on, you know, the period when I was growing up in the 1980s, when I was a teenager, you know, tail end of the Cold War, we were brought up to view asylum seekers as heroes, right? These were the people who had jumped the Berlin Wall. These were the people who defected to the West. You know, they were ballet dancers and mathematicians, physicists, and...
Not little black girls from Nigeria.
No, and this is something that's changed. You know, essentially what's changed is the skin color of the refugees, which is why it's there's a big underlying issue of race going on, which I'm really uncomfortable with. You know, I don't think that these people are worth less to us just because suddenly they're not, you know, white people from Russia. Okay, now they're black people from Nigeria, but they're still, you know, the most resilient, you know, the most resourceful, you know, the bravest people that you're likely to meet. And I just wanted to tell their story and, you know, make them human again.
When I was in England in 1972, Idi Amin kicked the Ugandan Asians out, basically people who were from India originally, but had lived in Uganda for generations. And he threw them all out for whatever his insane purposes were. And a lot of them came to England because they had Commonwealth passports. And I remember seeing the scrawled Keep England White on brick walls in mm-hmm. London, and I was horrified, you know, because I had this huge load of guilt about America's race problem, and suddenly here it was right in your face in England while I was there. Yeah. And I, you know, one hates to use the word schadenfreude, you know, that I was happy at other people's discomfort, but in a way I was, because the English had a really sanctimonious view of the United States, and here it was right in their faces that it wasn't so great there either.
Yeah, I mean, the United States has an amazing ability to change and work through social issues that it has, and I don't know that we have an ability to change and reform our concepts as quickly as you guys do. So it's definitely still a problem in the UK. There's an endemic suspicion of foreigners, and it's not the case in the big cities. You know, I come from London, and London is a blissfully multicultural place now, and you know, it's a wonderful place to live. It's a world city. It's terrific. And you drive 50 miles, you know, north or west, and it's not like that anymore. You're in a bunch of absolutely white towns and villages where attitudes are very different. And it's still the case, you know. And I don't think it's because people are bad. I think it's because people have got bad information. There's a lot of newspapers. And
people like the National Front play on that too.
They do,
for support.
Yeah, people, those sort of extreme political parties play on people who have a lack of information
and fear.
I think you can reverse that, right, by just very positively putting into the mix the idea that, you know, okay, here's a hero who is from a different ethnicity. You know, this is some. And look at the humanity. Don't look at their skin color. And that works really nicely in a novel, right? Because you're not looking at the person, you're just listening to their voice.
I promise you we'll talk about the book right now also. Title of the book, I would like to remind our listeners, is Little Bee, B-E-E, like the little creature. Chris Cleave, C-L-E-A-V-E, and it's Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Little Bee in the detention center. She has escaped Nigeria just barely with her life, and she falls in with three other young women, and they manage to get out. And I won't say how, but there is a character named Yvette, who is Jamaican from Kingston. And there's a nice little balance there, because it's Kingston upon Thames that Little Bee winds up in. And she gets them out through her own ingenuity, that is, Yvette does. And then tragedy begins to pile up, and Little Bee has one place that she knows where to go. And she knows that because she has the wallet of a man named Andrew O'Rourke. And she has found this wallet on the beach in Nigeria. I don't want to tread too heavily on what's going on there, because I want people to read this book and be surprised and horrified like I was. But Little Bee does manage to get to Kingston upon Thames. What's going on there? What kind of a family situation does she fall into?
When Little Bee is the refugee from Nigeria arrives in Kingston-on-Thames. She's there because, as you say, she's found the documents belonging to a family that she met in Nigeria. And that meeting occurred at the same time as the incident from which she's fleeing. So it turns out that she and this family that she's about to turn up on the doorstep of have a shared and very dark history revolving around a particular incident on a Nigerian beach. Where Sarah and her husband Andrew were on holiday you know, a few hundred meters from what's effectively a war zone. Now, Nigeria is one of the very few places on Earth where that could happen. Somewhere that's it's a very civilized country, Nigeria. It's a country that I ended up respecting more and more the more I researched it. English is the official language. It's a federal republic with more constitutional protections than we have in the United Kingdom, right? It's a civilized country.
Well, on paper, anyway.
Sure, on paper. And yet, in the Delta region in the south, you know, there's a lot of conflict over oil. So it turns out that little B is fleeing for her life. Sarah and Andrew are on holiday, and the two of them meet on a beach, and this is the first time they meet. Then 2 years later, when little B turns up as a refugee in the United Kingdom, the only people she knows in the UK, when she finally gets let out of the refugee detention centre, are Sarah and Andrew O'Rourke. She turns up on their doorstep one morning and just says, "Can you help me?" Which is absolutely out of the blue, and it reawakens in Sarah all of these memories about their first meeting, which she has managed to suppress for the last couple of years. She's managed to suppress those memories more effectively than her husband Andrew has. I mean, he's absolutely guilt-ridden about the fact that he might have been able to do more to save the situation from which little B has fled. And, you know, that has brought him into such a terminal decline that eventually he's taken his own life. So little B meets Sarah on the morning of Andrew O'Rourke's funeral. And this is how the book opens. So Sarah is feeling as if she's in a bad dream. She's just had all of these memories reawakened from what was the worst episode of her life on this African beach. Little B's just shown up and her husband's just died. And that means that we take this woman, Sarah, who just a few days ago had everything. She had a high-powered magazine job, a good husband. She also had an extramarital affair on the side. And she's got this wonderful son, Charlie.
Batman.
He thinks he's Batman. Yeah. He won't take off his costume and wants to be a superhero. And she has everything. And then a very few days later, the cracks in that life are suddenly and quite brutally exposed, and she has to come to terms with it. So the story that ensues over the next couple of hundred pages is that of Sarah realizing, you know, which parts of her own identity she's going to have to give up in order to become herself again, you know, in order to rebuild her life, and how much she's going to help little B along the way. And guess what? You know, it turns out that this help isn't a one-way street, because this comes back to the idea that we've been talking about, you know, refugees, asylum seekers. Well, they're not a burden. They're not necessarily a problem. They're not a drain on our resources. And it turns out that little B is going to help Sarah every bit as much as Sarah helps little B. And the big and it becomes a very warm and loving friendship. And between the two of them, they also manage to protect Charlie, who's Sarah's son. And that sort of triangular relationship is very strong, and it's beautiful, and yet it's so unlikely to succeed in a world that tries to put divisions between, you know, what we would call the developing world and the developed world. And the question in the book is whether that friendship's going to be strong enough to save these two women, or whether the world will inevitably, you know, encroach into that, split it up, and force the two women apart. Sarah probably to some kind of emotional destruction, and little B probably to some kind of physical destruction if she's deported back to Nigeria. So it's about the limits of human friendship and how important those friendships that transgress emotional, physical, and national borders are to hold the world together.
The little B's value to the family is indicated on the morning of the funeral, when Charlie, whose entire life seems circumscribed by the Batman world. He never takes off his Batman costume. He sure. sees the world in terms of black and white, goodies and baddies. Everybody's either a goodie or a baddie. Yeah. And he doesn't, he asks where his daddy is. He doesn't seem quite to understand what's happened to his father. But then he understands that his father is in that box that's going in the ground. And he acts out at the funeral in the most horrifying and heartbreaking way, throws himself on the coffin and Little B is the only one who has any calming effect on him. Sarah's beyond help. She can barely help herself and certainly can't help Charlie. That is one of the most affecting things I've ever read. And here I am thinking, this could actually happen, you know, for a four-year-old child to be confronted with death for the first time, when his worldview is a comic book worldview.
Yep.
What a horrifying thing.
Yeah, it is. And this is, I find it really heartbreaking, those moments where small people suddenly glimpse the world of big people and see that it isn't all happy.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the things, like, kids just do these most beautiful, heartbreaking and honest things. They just do what one would do. if he suddenly realizes that his dad's in that box, well, he wants to get his dad out. You know, kids don't believe in the possibility of death. And certainly not their own nor anyone else's. And he just wants to get his dad out of the box. That's what he tries to do.
That's why grown-ups laugh any time a kid says, I can't wait till I'm a grown-up. I can do whatever I like.
Sure.
Yeah. Ha-ha. Very funny.
Yeah.
Before I forget this, let me ask you about this. One of the things that's going on in Nigeria is that there's oil money there, and there's so much oil money there that it's corrupted everything.
All true.
And there are bad people doing bad things to other people for simple reasons of greed. But, of course, there's also human vileness comes into it at some point as well. And there's a whole string of thoughts that Little B has, and the chapters alternate, Sarah's mind, Little B's mind, first-person narration. And she starts a whole bunch of thought processes with the sentence, if the men come for me, tell us about that.
Sure. When I was reading, a lot of the research I did, I interviewed refugees and asylum seekers. I interviewed psychologists who work with them in the detention system. I interviewed activists who work to try to reform the immigration detention system. And I read a bunch of transcripts of refugee stories. And it is absolutely incredible how many of them begin, the men came and they. And then the story carries on. And you realize that, how much of the world is preyed upon by these sort of itinerant bands of males.
Darfur.
Who have been, brainwashed or in some way made part of some kind of a militia, which will either be legitimate, their government forces or their rebel forces or their mercenaries acting on behalf of this region or that company. And they're young men, and when I say young, I mean young. Sometimes they're 8 years old, right? It's a tragedy of that part of the world. It's the child soldiers who are so often roped into conflicts. And they tend to be men. And the brutal truth being that the surviving male combatants, the surviving males when there's an atrocity, are conscripted into a militia and become part of the cycle of violence, where the women, if they're lucky enough to escape, tend not to, right? And they tend to be the refugees that flee and tell their stories. So.
Unless they're conscripted as wives, quote unquote, for the men.
Yeah. And some of the atrocities that are visited upon them are just unimaginable. I mean, this is one of the things when I was researching this book. Some of the things that I read about will stay with me forever. Just in terms of the haunting cruelty, the sheer inventiveness of human cruelty.
Yeah. Little B's sister and Karuka, am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
She's the victim of one of the most horrifying things I've ever read, I think. The fact that it's not a horror fiction or, a murder mystery, it's the fact that this stuff goes on.
Yeah. That's the worst scene I've ever written. That's the most harrowing scene I've ever written. And people would be surprised maybe to know that, I had to write that down. I wasn't exaggerating. I was deliberately trying to use the minimum necessary force to convey just a small flavor of the kinds of things that these refugees might be fleeing from, right? They're not coming to the West on holiday. They're not coming for fun. They're fleeing from things that are literally far worse than death, right? I would take death in an instant before I would take some of the things that some of these people have been forced to participate in. Mm-hmm. And which obviously I won't go into that on the radio to upset people, but all I will say is that it's the one time as a writer when I've had to go for 10% of the effect that I could achieve, rather than I'm always trying to go for 110%. I'm always trying to take life and then turn up the gain on it very slightly and right. change the magnification.
That's what writers do.
Sure. Whereas in this scene, I was trying to write it down, and you know the scene as it appears in the book is 10% as bad as some of the things that I read about.
And thanks for not giving us the other 90%.
Yeah, I mean, but I wish, you know, there's these things that I wish I hadn't seen, that I wish I hadn't read, that I'm so grateful that I've never had to experience in my life. And the, researching this book made me completely reset the baseline of what I consider to be a good or a bad day.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Oh,
I mean, every day is a good day when we live in the West, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible how low humanity can go when all law and order is taken away and people have no civil rights. It's incredible how scary life can get, and it's incredible how much latent cruelty there is in not in everyone, but just in a very few people. There are enough sadistic people in the world so that when you take away the hand of governance from them, they will just create all merry hell.
We have maybe a minute left, and maybe I'm reading too much into this. Readers often do, but I seem to see with the relationship between Little B and Sarah and Lawrence, who is her lover, and the treatment that she got when she came to England, a kind of a metaphor for the entire colonial experience, both English and African. Am I seeing too much there, or was that part of it?
Well, I try to look at these big currents of human history. At the moment we're in this post-colonial phase of the West's relationship with Africa. And I guess my contention is that we need to be looking at Africa more in terms of, you know, what incredible people there are there. What incredible human ideals thrive in Africa. What incredible ways they have of being human that we can learn from, and we can do so much. And it shouldn't be all about us helping them. It's all about like how much they've got to teach us. Some of these people who, they come to our countries as refugees, and we treat them almost as animals and want to send them back.
Oh, worse.
Well, yeah.
If they were animals, the English would love them.
Sure. And I find that a monument to our own hubris, really. Mm-hmm. I think these people have as much to give to us as we have to give to them, because we're all human beings. And it's...
If they were Labrador retrievers, they'd have good homes in a minute.
That's absolutely right. We wouldn't treat animals the way we treat these people. And I just, to the extent in which the book is a metaphor, it's a metaphor for that. It's saying, well, look, these people have as much to give us as we have to give them. So let's move into a new phase in our relationship with Africa.
I reluctantly have to end the interview. This is the title of the book is Little B. Chris Cleave is the author, published by Simon & Schuster. Whatever you're working on now, come back and tell us about it.
Thanks very much, Ed.
Sure.